Hello, ladies and gentlemen, friends and strangers alike, and welcome to the first edition of the 100 Pockets Records podcast, brought to you by 100 Pockets Records. My name is Kurt Stein, and I'll be your host. With me today is my my buddy Luke Lorbecki.
Yep.
Who is sitting shirtless on a stool.
You know it.
Very close to me. We're sharing a microphone right now.
Our legs are touching.
Almost touching. Now we're touching. But this podcast is, like I said, brought to you by 100 Pockets Records. If you're not familiar with 100 Pockets Records, we are a mainly vinyl and digital download based record label, mainly based out of Brooklyn, New York. We've got some exciting things coming on, releases coming out this summer, that I'll talk more about. And, we do have some interesting releases out now by the likes of Christopher Hoffman, Ian Hoffman, Frank LaCrasto. Visit our website, www.100pocketsrecords.com, to learn more. But Luke and I are not in Brooklyn, New York.
Nope.
Not at all. We are in lovely Oshkosh, Wisconsin. For those of you who don't know where Oshkosh is, you spit in your hand by your thumb. If you're looking at your right hand.
Your right hand.
And you kind of spit by your thumb, you find Lake Winnebago, one of the largest inland lakes besides the Great Lakes. And you find the lovely Fox River that may be a spit trail running up your hand because it flows north. And we're nestled right near there. In fact, we just walked across the Fox. Luke and I went and had some delicious lunch where I coughed up a jalapeno popper into his chest and then spilled my drink all over the floor. So it's that kind of day. But yeah, we're two guys who have spent a long time trying to not work for the man, trying to get ideas that we like off the ground, you know. And we're located in this beautiful oasis of Wisconsin. So this podcast is going to be about, I think the focus is going to be on creativity, the idea of getting your ideas out where you don't have to change them in any way, shape, or form to get them out to a more mass audience. Trying to get things funded, trying to get people to help you to create projects you want to do, even when you're somewhat stranded in a location such as ours, right?
Absolutely.
Why are we here, Luke?
Because it's beautiful. It's like Shangri-La with cows.
That's pretty close. That's pretty dead on. But Luke and I
love milk and trees.
Milk, trees, serial killers, and fireworks and porn stores if you take the lovely Highway 41 to find us.
Mm-hmm.
Luke and I have tried many things in our life to not work for the man. I've been self-employed for about 13 years in the arts. I'm holding up my fingers, doing quotations, okay? I teach music and I play gigs and have tried to make movies and open clubs and throw in concerts and... another thing that I did was ran a magazine called Fever Pitch. Some people might know Fever Pitch. It was we did 9 issues of the magazine, 30 some CD, tape, and vinyl releases, and made quite a name for ourselves right when I got out of college. And I went to school for music business and recording, thinking I was going to learn everything I needed to tackle the industry and really make a difference. Little did I know that everything was turning digital in about a year, and we didn't have the idea of to stick with flying with the new wave. And now that we're doing this podcast, I think it should be noted that I, at one time in my life, while I was hanging out with some friends in New York, I actually met one of the guys who was one of the first guys who figured out how to make podcasting work. And he suggested podcasting the magazine. Did I take him up on that, Luke?
No.
No, not at all. I couldn't understand why anyone would want to do anything like this.
Sounds ridiculous.
It took me maybe 8-10 years to figure out that, oh yeah, maybe that's what people might be into. But so we're going to try this. So I'm sure there's a lot of other people out there, friends of ours, people who don't know us, that feel the same way we do. That maybe we weren't trained in the things we want to be trained in. Maybe we got to find that internally and figure out how to make things happen on our own. So the start of these podcasts is going to be a bunch of phone interviews I did for Fever Pitch magazine back in the thousands. Does that even sound weird to say?
Wouldn't it be the 2000s? The two aughts?
The aughts. Back in the aughts. And back in the two aughts, I did a bunch of interviews, and you're going to hear the likes of David Cross, Bruce Campbell from the Evil Dead movies, Chuck D from Public Enemy, Andrew Alexander, who's the founder of Second City, and a couple other interesting ones. And this one that we're going to start off with, which is an interview with Ira Glass from This American Life, that I did back in February of 2004.
Smooth.
Yeah, you like that?
Yeah.
I know, that was smooth. There may or may not have been an edit there because I didn't have the date of the tape in front of me. And perhaps I went and took a whiz and then forgot that I was looking for the tape and then came back and did the recording.
Or not.
Or not. But anyway, it's a recording I did with Ira Glass from This American Life. Like I said, in February of 2004. And Ira's a very smart gent. And started something that I think is very important. He does basic human storytelling, truth is stranger than fiction stuff, things that we're very interested in. You know, you can't manufacture some of the stories that they come up with, some of the weirdos they find.
I had a friend who had a theory about that.
Yeah, what's that?
He said that fiction is based on things we know, whereas true things that are strange that happen because there are no rules.
Oh, I like that.
Nothing has been set up yet.
I like that. Why are you trying to be so prolific on this show?
I just have prolific friends.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I understand that. Since you're sitting there shirtless and tattooed with no shoes on. Wearing a scruffy beard.
It's
and
hot.
There's also blood on his chest. On his tattoo of Cthulhu, for some reason. There's a blood on his chest.
It's hot in Shangri-La.
It is hot in Shangri-La. But anyway, you're going to be listening to an interview I did with Ira, and he talks about how... realize, too, that none of these recordings were ever meant for release. They were simply phone interviews I did to then transcribe and get ready for print in the magazine. So I never wrote any questions down. I just kind of winged it, trying to find, you know, a cool theme or a cool idea, and asked a lot of questions that I had about the industry that often make me look foolish because I had no clue how anything worked. And so I figure rather than maybe reading a book or doing some research, you just go right to the source, right?
Absolutely. I thought you sounded knowledgeable. I thought you did research.
You thought I did? Well, honestly. I knew about the people, but I don't know about how the industry works sometimes. So I'm sure a lot of us have questions on how to, you know, create a story, maybe how This American Life does. And Ira goes in depth on how that happens and has a lot to say about creativity and the creative mind, and we're going to be doing more of this in this podcast. So if you have any ideas about other people you might want to hear us interview, please email me at kurt@100pocketsrecords.com. That's Kurt with a K, not with a C. K-U-R-T @100pocketsrecords.com.
Is that 100 pockets? Or the word 100?
That is the word 100. That's very good. I'm glad we cleaned that up, Luke. Yes, it's K-U-R-T at 100, as in the word 100, pocketsrecords.com. But I do ask a lot of naive questions, and Ira bears with me and answers them quite eloquently, I think. So and I should add that at the end of this podcast, you're going to hear a sneak preview track of 100 Pockets Records release. We have the track Surf Avenue from my buddy Frank Lucrasto. He's an amazing pianist, keyboardist, and composer off his album El Dorado. And you can get that at 100pocketsrecords.com. Be a pal. Support the cause. So without further ado, unless you have any parting words, Luke, till the end of this thing.
For now, I'm out.
Okay, good. Well, without further ado, here is my interview with Ira Glass from This American Life for Fever Pitch Magazine from February of 2004.
Hello?
Hello, Kurt.
Hey, Ira. I was just about to call you.
Oh, that's good.
So, you ready to do this?
Yes, I am.
The magazine never came, I take it.
The magazine did come. It came yesterday, actually.
Oh, did you get a chance to look at it?
Yes, I did.
What? Any opinions? I'm always looking for more opinions.
You like MC Pro Barman a lot more than I do.
Oh, really? he actually became kind of a friend of mine, so...
Really?
Yeah.
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 I feel like I was ambivalent on him, and then my girlfriend sort of hates him, so I'm afraid she's turned me to the other side.
Really?
Yeah.
That's understandable. How about how about the rest of the issue?
It's good. It's good.
Did you happen to see the review?
Yes, that was very flattering. Thank you.
I meant it a lot.
Thank you.
And my grandfather actually passed away last weekend, so...
Oh, I'm sorry.
That was kind of, you know, but, you know, he got me into NPR. That's interesting.
Oh.
I guess I kind of want to get some background on you. Where did you, where and what did you go to school for? And were you always into journalism and broadcasting?
I went to school originally as a radio TV film major and pre-med, and then switched schools and ended up a semiotics major. Semiotics actually turned out to be very, very handy because it's this very pretentious body of theory that in the end is all about what makes a story compelling.
Mm-hmm.
That is like sort of old literary theory or film theory, was sort of about the author's intent. You know what it. You know what is. What does Dostoevsky mean? How does this fit in with his life? The meaning of the story. What does Francis Ford Coppola mean in Apocalypse Now? Whereas what semiotics is interested in is, what is it about this movie, this scene, this moment that just gets to you? And why does this work better than other things that are trying to do it? And honestly, like, it just gives you a kind of grab bag of tools and ways to think about how to tell a story that come in handy a lot if you're in, you know, my line of work.
Mm-hmm. Were you into stories and human interest stuff like that for a long time?
No, one is. That would be really horrible and corny. No, I watched TV and I went to the movies like everybody else in America.
How did This American Life come about, and how did you hook up with the Chicago Public Radio?
I mean, I've been working as a reporter for NPR and a producer for years and years and for years and years and years, and 8 years ago when we started the show, basically I was a reporter that NPR would send around on all sorts of different assignments, including very documentary-ish assignments. They sent me into a high school for a year. They sent me into an elementary school for a year, filing stories every week or two. And those stories, if you'd ever hear them, they have a lot of the feeling of the stories in This American Life. There are characters, and they're in some situation, and you want to find out what happens to them, and there'll be funny little moments, and there'll be emotional moments. I mean, they're full stories. And so I was doing stories like that, and then I was also producing people like David Sedaris and others for Morning Edition, just because it seemed like somebody should. And I thought, like, well, you could put all these things together into one show, and it would be nice.
And do you pitched it to them, and they went for it?
It's a much more complicated and ultimately uninteresting story. what happened was is that the public radio station here in Chicago... got an offer of a little bit of money, actually not all that much money, got an offer of a little bit of money and basically came to me and said, do you want to start a show? And I had this idea and they went for it.
Awesome. That's really cool. Did they, how long did it, I mean, you guys have quite a following now. How long did it take you to drive a wedge into the listeners and attract new... I think you guys have attracted listeners that NPR never had before.
I mean, what happened... Like, it was more successful than we thought, and more successful right from... It was more successful than we thought it would be, and that was true right from the beginning. But it took a while to build to the size it is now. I mean, now it's on 470 radio stations and 1.5 million people hear it each week. At the beginning, like, our plan was, like, I can't remember if we thought, like, at the end of year two, if we were on 60, 65 stations by the end of the second year, we thought we'd be doing great.
Mm-hmm.
It took off way faster than we thought. And so by the end of year two, we were on over 200 stations.
How many people started it, and how many people work for This American Life now, just on This American Life?
I mean, it started with a staff of four people, Me and three others, and now we're double that, basically.
Wow.
So it's still pretty small, I gotta say.
Do you get a lot of people sending stories in and writing in and?
Tons, and we do use that stuff. Pretty much, there's one story every other week that's just somebody who wrote to us out of the blue, and we thought, like, okay, that person.
Who weeds through all that crap?
What?
Who weeds through all of that?
Well, I mean, there are two tiers. I mean, the intern actually does the first pass, and then our senior producer, Julie Snyder, looks at anything, you know, that the intern passes up to her. And then there are a lot of, like, people who are professional writers who will just write to us out of the blue, and they'll usually get in contact with our senior producer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a combination of the lowest person on the totem pole and the highest person on the totem pole together, kind of go through that stuff.
Have you accomplished everything you wanted to do with the show? Or do you still have things that you haven't been able to finance or anything that you would like to see more of?
I mean, I think there are things that we could always do better. I mean, I feel like we have a lot of stories about people. We have a lot of stories about people who aren't white and aren't in the same demographic mm-hmm. that we are, but we don't have a lot of writers who are not white and,
right.
and in the same demographic that we are. And, like, honestly, we could do a better job. It just takes more time to find writers for us to go out and search. And so a lot of what ends up, and so kind of unintentionally, like, that's happened. Like, we could do a better job with that. There could be, in general, like, a greater variety of voices, I think. I feel like there's a range, but I think we could do better. I think everybody on the staff feels like we could do better with that.
Wow.
Having said that, you know, like, we're at a point where there's enough money and enough time that we can kind of pull off anything
mm-hmm.
that we decide to do. So we've done things like, you know, we did a show from an aircraft carrier that was, you know, launching missions over Afghanistan, and
mm-hmm.
you know, we did, you know, a show where we spent 24 hours at one diner. We did a show where we're planning on a set of stories from Iraq. You know, like we have the resources to kind of do to fulfill our ideas.
To lead into that stuff, what do you? We just nailed Kucinich too. I just found out yesterday that he's going to be in the next issue too, which I didn't expect to see.
Huh?
But we scored an interview with him, so
that's great.
We're doing some stuff with him. How much? How do I want to put this? How do you? What's your political agenda, but how much do you feel that politics should be involved in your show? And do you want?
I feel like politics shows up in the show to the same degree that it is. I think it shows up in most of our lives. It's one of the things that we're interested in, and we're not always interested in it. But like everybody else, like, you know, just as people, you know, we're interested in it. And so when election season comes around, like, we always end up doing a bunch of stories and a bunch of shows about it. Really, like, even before September 11th, we were starting to do, like, a set of newsier shows, just because it seemed like it would be fun to go in and use our way of telling a story, where you know, it's more like a little movie. With
right.
characters and scenes. It would be fun to do, you know, campaign coverage. It would be fun to do stuff on the war on terror. It would be interesting to do stuff about, you know, civil liberties and things like that, using our style. And so we've, you know, there's a lot of material that we've gone through like that.
Do you try to show the more individual human side of things when you do that kind of thing, rather than encompassing the entire subject, or show how it affects a certain?
I mean, ideally, you want to do both. Like, you want the individual story to gesture at some big new idea about how everything works.
By focusing on the minute and then seeing the broad from looking at that.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, honestly, like, sometimes we end up just doing stories on things that got a tiny, they're getting a tiny bit of play, but we feel like there's way more to say about them. And so, you know, a year ago, we started doing, like, we did a whole huge thing about all the government secrecy and sort of what, kind of like what exactly, where we put together things that were sort of out there in a bunch of different stories and sort of put them together and to say, like, well, what is the extent of what's going on right now? And as part of that, one of the stories we did was on this guy, Jose Padilla, who's been incarcerated now under new guidelines set by the Bush administration. He's not charged with anything, and he's not allowed to see a lawyer, and he's an American citizen. And, you know, like, he's somebody who in the months since has gotten more attention. Mm-hmm. But we were very early on just saying, like, what the hell? You know, like it's nice to be able, like, you know, we've got a radio show and we've got 1.5 million people listening. And if something seems sort of strange or noticeable or outrageous to us, like, it's nice that we can just kind of dive into it and say, like, what the hell is that about?
Oh, that's very cool. How do you go from finding a subject you personally, I mean, not both as if you were going to do an individual story yourself, and as how you produce one for the show, how do you, when you find something you want to research, how do you decide how much interview material do you guys actually do, and how do you weed through all that, and how do you actually set up your direction to play, like you said, as like a mini movie? How do you seem to have the style down very well, and how do you have a method to that, or?
I mean, generally, you know, what we're looking for is what people who do, you know, feature magazine stories or do a kind of feature journalism are also looking for, which is, you know, we need a person to tell the story through. We need somebody compelling who's going through something that's interesting and dramatic. And so we look for that first. Having said that, like, often, like, you can't find the perfect person, and just the facts of what's going on are kind of interesting, and so you just kind of go with the facts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know?
And once you've interviewed, I mean, like, when you get some pieces done, are they, do some of these writers send in completed pieces?
I mean, we're, like, huge, obsessive, you know, editors, and so, although, like, we're lucky that we get to work with a lot of really good writers, you know, we will shape and reshape and reshape and reshape a story over and over and over again. I mean, as you and I are doing this interview, like, this week, we're putting on the story that David Rakoff is doing, and he's a really experienced writer and a really funny writer, and has been on the show tons of times. And, you know, we had him do this thing where it was really an experiment, where we had read how people who fast have a kind of spiritual enlightenment,
mm-hmm.
And they feel a sense of greater clarity, and some of them, you know, just it can be a religious experience for many people, and so we basically have him go on a 20-day fast, and so this is like a huge project because we're basically having him turn over 3 weeks of his life to us, and you know, he recorded little audio diaries during it. We did interviews, and then we went out and we interviewed. We must have interviewed, like, I want to say like a dozen different people who had fasted, also to compare their experience with David's and research the medical science behind, does this actually help your health? And in the end, you know, like, you know, and his first draft was 40 minutes long, and, you know, like, on the radio, the final story will be 25 minutes long.
Wow.
And, you know, it's gone through draft after draft after draft. And, you know, that's what makes something good, generally, is that, you know, you think it through and you think it through and you think it through and make it so that it hits its ideas in the cleanest possible way and doesn't repeat itself and raises questions that then it's able to answer. You know, like I don't know, like I think in making anything, you'll find that, like, for it to be good, generally, people have to rework it over and over.
How long does it take you to go from initial idea to finished show on the air?
I mean, it depends on the show. Like generally for us, it takes 3 or 4 months to have enough stories that we think are good enough to make a whole show.
And around a similar subject, or?
Yeah, where they're all on a similar subject and kind of work with each other in a nice way.
Sometimes you have to farm out, like, you'll say, okay, well, we've got, you know, this is a great idea for a show, but we only have 2 pieces. We need another we need another piece, and then try to brain. Do you guys brainstorm to come up with another idea?
Yeah, that's every show. That's every show. Like, and for this week's show, honestly, like, I know two of the stories that are going to be in this show, but we still haven't decided which is going to be the third story. And we have three contenders right now. One is there's a story about LSD that we've been working on. One is a story about this kid whose mom was a mail order bride, and one is the story that we sort of have in the can left over from an earlier show that never made it on the air because it wasn't time, about these kids on a train. And honestly, like, we're pushing ahead on all three of them. It's Wednesday, you know, the show goes on the air on Friday, and I probably won't know till tonight, like, which one actually seems like the best one. So all those stories came about with us trying to figure out what would go with these other two stories that we've got. That we knew we had. So you know, yeah, there's a lot of you know, there's a lot of stuff like that.
Oh wow, that is a lot of to take in. Have you thought of doing any other mediums, any film stuff, or?
I mean, we have right now a movie deal with Warner Brothers, where basically they get dibs on stories that have been on the radio show, and from that deal, they've kind of tapped five different stories that we've had on the air over the years to go into development
as a full length feature film.
As full length feature films.
Holy cow!
Having said that, yeah, well, who knows if anything will, if they'll ever get made, but you know, they're going through the process.
And then
we're also talking about periodically, you know, it comes up the question of should we do a TV show, and so that's kind of like an ongoing question too.
Have you guys been approached by larger corporate companies to be bought out?
Well, we can't really be bought out, like, in the way that, like, Disney can be bought out by Comcast, because you know, we're just a show at a public radio station.
But they can't purchase the idea for the show and actually, you know, like, get you, you know, pay you an exorbitant amount of money to you know, come to their evil flock or anything like that.
Like, what are you talking? You mean like the Fox Network would see us and think like, now there's a good reality show in that.
It's, well, maybe not This American Life, but say, oh, Ira Glass. Okay, I love this guy's work. If we got him to produce a show for us along the lines of This American Life, you know what I mean? Has anything, you know, come to you like that? That's what I guess I'm asking. Maybe it's a stupid question, but
I mean, you know, nothing. Nothing real.
Nothing real.
Yeah,
I gotcha. Is there, what goals do you have for the future of the show and for yourself? What would you like to accomplish?
I mean, it's hard doing the show. Like I gotta say, like this is a job that I don't feel like I've completely mastered.
You're still learning all the time, even after 8 years.
It's funny. It's not like I feel like I learn new things. Like, in fact, one of the reasons that we talked about doing a TV show or doing movies is just because it would be fun to learn something new. Like, I feel like everything about that you could know about making this show that we make, I feel like, you know, after 8 years, if you haven't mastered your job, like, what kind of idiot are you, you know? Like, like anybody in the same job for 8 years. Like, I feel like I have a grip on, like, what's called for in this job. The thing that's hard is just, you know, finding and executing stuff that seems utterly new. Like, that's continuously challenging for me and for the staff. And that makes it really interesting, and it makes it really hard. Like, it's just as hard to make a great episode of the show now as it was in the first year. I mean, some things about it are easier. Like the staff totally is better trained and knows what they're doing, and we have a track record, and we know we can do this and that and this and that, whereas in the first year everything was just, we were making it up on the fly. But like, actually coming up with ideas that are interesting enough and people who can execute them, you know, in the stories, like, that's just as hard now. Like it doesn't get any easier. Mm-hmm. If anything, like, our standards are higher, so it's harder.
Oh, I can definitely see that. Because, well, even though the show concept may be easier, that you have ironed out stuff like that, it's still, to get a real working product must be a total nightmare sometimes.
Sometimes.
Do you guys have an in-house music mixer and editor and all that yourself?
Sadly, no. Like, we'd probably be better off if we did. Like, what happens is that, you know, our show goes on the public radio satellite on Friday nights, and on Thursday, in a panic, we all realize, oh, my God, we need music. And so then we use the music that we've got around, which means that, unfortunately, I think we overuse a lot of the music. We use a lot of the same stuff too often. We've gotten better about that in the last year, but still, I think we could be better.
From running Fever Pitch, I've come into a lot of musical. I have a vast knowledge of music, and you guys use some pretty obscure stuff on that. Does it all come from personal collections and whatever you guys feel might be the right thing to play, or?
It's a combination of people's personal collections, but also like all of us are on the lookout for anything that could work as music in the show, you know. And what we need is like so specific. Like we need instrumental music that's compelling, but not so compelling that you listen to that instead of the words that are being said. You know, like sometimes bands will send a record and it will be instrumental music, and they're just in a way they're too. It's like they're too adventurous, you know what I mean? Like there's lots of bands that are just like they're like it's too alive to sit underneath somebody talking. So there's a funny mix of stuff that works, and some people like some of their stuff will work and some won't.
Do you guys personally what styles of music and what types of musicians do you like?
I mean, Jane is so deep into hip hop, it's sort of crazy. A lot of other people on the staff, I think, are more like alternative rock. And then I wouldn't say that most of us are so deeply inside in the world of music that you could even call us, real big music fans. Like honestly, like we're so busy just even pulling together the show, and then at the end of the day, we're exhausted. After working 10 or 12 hours, that, I've gone through phases in my life where I was actively getting new records and going to shows and thinking about new music. And, it's such a labor of love and an investment of time, to really be having new bands that you really love all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I and the other staffers, like, we don't get that much time for that.
Right.
So often the stuff that I hear about is through my girlfriend, who for a while was a music reviewer at Playboy, and now works on a weekly paper here in Chicago, and does some music stuff. And and I'm constantly asking friends,
about what to listen to and what to get
about what they're listening. Yeah, about what they're listening to. My nephews are teenagers, I talk to them a lot. They both play instruments, and one of them's in a band, and I get a lot of music from them, actually.
Have you did you have any role models or idols of not doing exactly what you wanted to do, but who did you have in mind when you were creating the show and doing this kind of stuff? Who are your biggest influences, whether it be literary, film wise, or other?
I mean, there's lots of people whose work I really love. I mean, people who were helpful to me as like role models were mostly really helpful to me in my 20s, but like which is sadly like long before I started This American Life. Like I'm kind of a late bloomer. Like This American Life, we didn't put on the air till I was 35.
Oh wow!
But when I was trying to like learn to write and to do work on the radio, there were a couple people at NPR who I really admired. At the time, I was working at NPR in Washington. But none of them were, like, the big, famous-y names. One of them was this guy named Alex Chadwick, who was just a really unusually graceful, poetic writer, though not in a way that made you hate his guts. Like, it didn't seem pretentious, the way he wrote for radio. It seemed like he was just a really thoughtful, smart guy. And when I was trying to learn to write for radio, sometimes I would totally get stuck, and then I would just pretend that I was writing it in the voice of Alex Chadwick for Alex Chadwick to read. And honestly, that got me through a lot of stories.
Wow.
Yeah, like I totally recommend for people who are trying to like make original work that imitating people is a good technique. I think like I had the same thing all through my 20s that I think a lot of people have in their 20s, which is I knew I wanted to do a job where there'd be like creative work, you know, it seemed like it would be really fun. And I had good taste, you know what I mean? Like I could tell what was good and what was bad, and I had very specific taste, you know, stuff I liked and all of that, which I think it's like a lot of people in their 20s who want to do creative work, like that's kind of what they have going for them. But I wasn't very talented. Like I wasn't very good. Like I wasn't a good writer. In fact, I was sort of a terrible writer. And so I experienced a thing that I think a lot of people experience, which is this frustrating gap between my ambition and the stuff I liked and the stuff that I was actually able to make myself. And it's really hard to get past that. And in fact, like one of the things that's weird is that nobody ever talks to you about it. Like that there's this phase where you've got good taste, right? Because that's what made you interested in making stuff, but your skills aren't that good. So whenever you make something, your taste is good enough and you're a rational enough person that you could tell it's crap. and you could tell it's crap, and so it's sort of hard to keep going, right?
I feel like
every creative person I know, except for like the one or two sort of super geniuses, like every creative person I know went through this phase where they knew what I'm making is crap. And like honestly, like that takes years to get through, and you just have to force yourself to slog through those years. And for me, I feel like I was way longer than most people I know. Like honestly, like I started working at NPR. The network level, like at NPR in Washington, when I was 19, and I was not a decent radio writer until I would say I was 28 or 29. Like, I wasn't even close to it for most of that period. Do you know what I mean?
I feel the exact same way, man, with running this magazine. I mean, if you saw three issues ago, it looked like a completely different magazine.
I'm sorry, I have to put you on hold. I'm so sorry, hold up.
No,
400 million, I think it's actually the exact number, is $396 million more dollars a year this year for K-12 education. I know the main concern among many legislative critics of his plan to sort of supplant the Illinois State Board of Education is, what is this really doing? Is this a bureaucratic shift? Is this a shift of jobs and authority? Or is it really going to deal with the fundamental problem of funding? I think the real problem is, at least according to many legislators, is the state needs to stop its over-reliance on property taxes to fund education. So I think for some legislators in support of education, they might see this money as just sort of a fake high.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess we were just talking about influences and,
yes,
and that kind of stuff.
So I'm going to have to ring off for a thing I have to do.
Sure, no problem. I think I have enough to...
Do you have enough?
Any closing comments for people, since we're on the subject of finding yourself in creative development, any other, for up-and-coming creative people... what advice do you have for them to hone their skills and really get what they have in their head down?
I mean, like for me, I feel like the two things I wish people had said to me was, one, there's nothing wrong with spending years like not being great at it, and that's actually part of the deal, and that you just have to keep plugging away. Yeah, and which is what I did, but I had no encouragement at all. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like I was not very good, and I basically just forced myself through one story after another, after another, after another, and just willed it to happen. And then the other thing is that nobody ever tells you, another thing is that one of the problems, if you want to do creative work, is like, what are you going to do creative work about? You know what I mean? Like, what's going to be the subject of it? And like, I think a lot of us, like, have an impulse of, like, it would be really fun to make stuff, but it's not clear, like, well, what's the subject of it? And nobody ever says that, like, figuring out the subject of it is kind of part of the job, and you have to sort of plan on devoting, like, time and energy to finding something that's interesting to you to write about or to make stuff about, and that there's nothing wrong with that. That basically you sort of set aside time and money to buying magazines and looking at movies and renting stuff and listening to music and just like looking for an idea that's compelling enough that you want to take some corner of it and go into it yourself, and that looking for the idea is sort of part of the job.
Don't expect your first attempt to be Citizen Kane, you know.
Well, definitely don't expect that.
I totally understand where you're coming from. That's awesome, man.
Okay, well, I'm very sorry. I have to ring right off, but I have a 1:30 train with somebody that I've put off like 4 times that I've got to go to.
No problem. I will be applying for the internship, so watch.
Well, good luck to you. You should know that, like, when people apply for that internship, often, like, they don't get it the first time, but you can call the producer who's doing the internship, and you can ask, kind of like, what did I need that I didn't have if you don't happen to get it the first time?
Sure.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Ira.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, there you have it. That's my interview with Ira Glass from February of 2004 for Fever Pitch Magazine, the first installment in our the Lost Fever Pitch Tape series. And at the end there, when I'm talking to Ira about that internship that I was going to pursue, you think I ever pursued that, Luke?
Nah, not that I recall.
Do you think I would have had a good chance of getting it, seeing as though he'd already seen the magazine I published and talked to me about it on the phone?
Yeah, probably.
Wow, I really should have done that, probably, huh?
Yeah.
Let me get out my book of failed dreams and things I should have done, and we'll write that one down there.
Add it to the list.
I find it very important to keep 2 journals in life. My regular journal, which is like my happiness journal when I talk about good things. Then I have a cry journal. Just for times when I need... Every time I've cried, I just pencil in there. I cried and why. Who was responsible.
Maybe...
So I can exact, you know, some kind of revenge later.
The regret encyclopedia. The encyclopedia of regret.
I just call it the cry journal.
The cry journal.
It's got tears on the front, and sometimes I'll draw tears on it.
You don't regret not doing the things, but they make you sad.
They make me sad that I can't clone myself and do 5,000 other things. You know what I mean? I thought it was really interesting, though, especially when I was talking about being creative, and that sometimes maybe the medium you're in isn't the medium you should be in. Some people think that they, you know, they want to be a writer, or they want to be a musician, or they want to be an actor or a filmmaker, but perhaps your skills and your brain are set for something else, which I think a lot of people don't figure out till way too late.
Yeah.
Or you can just do like me and try to be some weird modern Renaissance man and do all of it at once.
Do them all. Pick the one you're the least crappy at.
Jack of all trades, master of none.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a couple things I'm good at. But otherwise, you know, just keep trying. You know, I like to look at the way that you can wear many hats, and but you get to make your own hats. You know, and sometimes they're made of silk or a fine velour, and sometimes they're made out of newspaper or recycled shopping bags. That being said, we're going to wrap this podcast up. Next time you're going to get to listen to an interview I did with David Cross, and everyone should know who the comedian David Cross is now from Arrested Development, Todd Margaret, Mr. Show, and other things. But this was before a lot of people knew who he was. It was right after Mr. Show, so I hope you enjoy that. And again, I ask that you visit 100pocketsrecords.com. That's 100 spelled out, okay? And also write me at kurt@100pocketsrecords.com, and that's Kurt with a K. And let us know what you think of the show. Insult us.
Good or bad, we'll read it all.
Good or bad, we will read it all. It would be really nice to know that somebody's listening. And again, visit the website, check out some of the vinyl, get a digital download, support the cause. Come on. Support independent music. It almost hurts me to say that sometimes. I mean it, but it's like, it's like sitting down with a man. I believe it, but something in me says, why is that coming out of your mouth? But support independent music. Damn it.
Damn the man.
And sending you out tonight, you're going to hear, like I as promised, the track Surf Avenue by Frank Locrasto from his 100 Pockets Records release, El Dorado.
Yeah.
I love this song. It reminds me of 60s rock and roll, some early electronic, and it's great longboarding with your pit bull music. The entire album, El Dorado, is great. There's something on there for everyone.
It's a very specific activity.
Definitely. We'll get more into my urban mushing addiction later. But without further ado, here's Frank Locrasto, Surf Avenue. I'm Kurt Stein. That's Luke Lorbecki over there.
Yep.
Shirtless and dirty. For the 100 Pockets Records podcast. Enjoy. See you next time.